Hey there, you're listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. In today's episode, I speak with Dr. Philip Jenkins. Philip is Distinguished Professor of History and Director of the Program on Historical Studies of Religion at Baylor University. He's written numerous books and essays on a honestly dizzying range of topics. His essays also often appear in the pages of the Christian Century, where I especially enjoy reading his essays about film and media. Today, we are discussing his brand new book, A Storm of Images, Iconoclasm and Religious Reformation in the Byzantine World. This is a fascinating book, so I think you will really enjoy this conversation. Here it is. Dr. Philip Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
Could you begin by introducing our listeners to the Iconoclast era and some of the difficulties associated with studying it?
Sure. It's an era in the 8th and 9th centuries, and you can describe it in a way that makes it sound very obscure and out of the way because it takes place in what's called the Byzantine Empire. And that would be in the East Mediterranean. But a better way of describing it is it's in the surviving Roman Empire, which was the world's greatest Christian power, Christian empire at that time. And it had a furious internal war going on over a theological issue. Basically, how far should holy figures like Christ or the Virgin Mary be represented in material form? And there were some people who were accused of breaking images. And the famous story is you would have a great image of Christ and they would send soldiers to tear down this image. And from the Greek words, that would be breaking an image, icon, iconoclasm. Mm-hmm. The word icon is a little bit misleading because we all know what an icon is. It's something that the Orthodox churches have and, you know, Protestants or Catholics think, well, we don't have icons. No, but the word means image. Mm. So it would include stained glass windows. It would include paintings. It would include textiles or wood or whatever. And simply there was a faction that said that you should not have images like this and they wanted to remove them. And there were other people who said, yes, we absolutely should. They're a fundamental part of Christian devotion. And that war, and I use the word advisedly because it was often very violent and bloody, lasted for approximately 150 years mm-hmm. at a time when the Roman Empire was facing the threat of extermination by the Islamic world, but they still thought this was probably a more important thing to worry about.
Yeah. So you say, and this is a quote, iconoclasts were asking fascinating and innovative questions, end quote. Give us a few examples of these fascinating and innovative questions and tell us why they're so interesting to you.
Okay, when we look at the Middle Ages and we think of Christianity in the Middle Ages, we all have certain pictures and certain concepts of what those churches would be like. And we think of people, you know, bowing before statues and so on, and all the learning, all the wealth is in the hands of the clergy and the monasteries. And sometimes we have this very condescending view, and we think, well, gee, that's all people were mentally capable of in that time. They weren't capable of moving beyond that. If you look at the disputes at that time, the so-called iconoclasts, and I'll explain that in a second, were probably, and there's a little bit of debate about it, saying something very much like the Reformation. They were saying that you should not have all the power focused on clergy and monasteries. You should not have people paying superstitious devotion to saints' relics. You should not even have monks. Monks should be stripped of their black robes and forced to marry and live regular lives. So in a sense, they're 800 years ahead of their time in that way. And they're very concerned about what we would call superstition. And when there are stories attached to, like, a miraculous figure of the Virgin, which supposedly cures people, their best solution is, well, if you will burn the image, and then we won't have that as a problem anymore. So it's sweeping. So it's interesting for being ahead of its time, but it's not just vandalism. They have a very different view of what Christian spirituality should look like and how it should avoid being, as they see it, tainted. So we can actually reconstruct what an iconoclast church would look like. And just imagine a great church like, oh, St. Paul's in London. And the only illustration would be a great figure of a cross, not a crucifix, a cross.
No body upon it. It's just
no body upon it. Exactly. And you think about it, that's rather far ahead of its time in many ways. You know, different people may like different aesthetics with churches. I personally am very happy with a fairly sort of high and visual concept of churches. But if you are a very Protestant Christian, then you really would understand where the iconoclasts were coming from. So really, they've had a very bad historical rap in lots of ways. They're not just vandals.
Yeah. So it sounds like iconoclasts were asking questions not just about images or even a theology of images. They were raising questions about hierarchy in the church, or who held power in the church. They were raising questions about Christian life and spirituality, all of which came to a head in a disagreement over images. Is that right?
That's right, and particularly the idea of authority. By what authority do you do this? And also, you know, what is the church? By the way, you see I'm being very careful about this term, iconoclasts.
Yeah.
There's a huge debate here, which is very, very important. The image that we have in many of the early historians is this, that, you know, the church was filled with these glorious images, and then these nasty people, these vandals came in and started breaking them down, and they tried to do the sweeping reform. There's an alternate theory which says that it's only in very recent times before that that they'd started putting up all these images and claimed that they were miracle working. And what the iconoclasts were fairly conservative people who said, we're not going to have, you know, bleeding figures of the saints and curing figures of the Virgin. This is new. We don't like it. Get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we talk about breaking. A lot of it was maybe whitewashing over it, taking down the image, putting up it up in a higher place so people couldn't bow before it. Right. So, as I say, they've had something of a bad rap.
Yeah. And you also distinguish, or maybe not distinguish, but you mention that there's a difference between aniconic and iconoclastic. So you use a couple of examples of churches that simply don't have a lot of imagery around. They're not going around doing anything to others' images. They just simply don't have images or don't prefer images. And I think that, yeah, those sorts of terminological distinctions and clarifications are really helpful.
Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, the obvious example for me, I teach at Baylor University. There are many, many Baptist churches nearby. And by and large, they do not have images in. They certainly don't have figures of saints in. That doesn't mean that they were once there and they decided to smash them all.
Right.
It's just that's their decision. They built it. We don't believe that's an appropriate way of proceeding with Christian worship and devotion. We put our emphasis on other things.
Mm-hmm.
So when we use the word iconoclast, we have to be a little bit careful.
Yeah.
And The other point with that is it does underline the fact that it's the winners, in this case, far more than in most cases, who totally wrote the story.
Right.
And they shaped the narrative. And it makes it quite an effort to try and dig beyond that.
Yeah, the historical difficulties are immense.
Right.
So speaking of that, what are some of the main ways that scholars have narrated this story for?
Sure. There are a number of contemporary sources that tell us about what happened, or at least the things that were written maybe a couple of decades after the event. And they tell a very dramatic series of stories about this emperor comes along and he decides to sweep away the images. And there's a famous scene, for example, where his soldiers bring down this great image of Christ in the city. That causes a riot by pious women. Many people are killed. And we have this story that carries on with its heroes and villains, entirely written from the point of view of the pro-image faction. And people basically believed that for hundreds of years. And in relatively modern times, people have said, well, how do you know this? Yeah. And in the famous story of bring down the great figure of Christ Pantocrator, the ruler of all in the city, many people have said, well, as far as we can tell, it wasn't actually there at the time it was meant to be destroyed. It's a retroactive story. And virtually none of the early events in the story are uncontroversial. So someone will say, well, this Emperor Leo passed a law in this year. Well, prove it. Emperor Leo punished the Pope by taking away lots of lands from him. Well, as far as we can tell, it happened 20 years after that, so it had nothing to do with this. And people have gone back and forth. And, the only word you can use for this kind of attack is, I'm trying to avoid the word, iconoclastic. They're trying to smash traditional orthodoxies. And my argument is they're making absolutely, they're asking wonderful questions. How do you know this? How do you know this? Can you prove this? And some people would basically say the whole iconoclastic controversy is something of a myth. And so my view and what really pushed me to write the book is we now have so much writing, so much work from both sides. It really is time for a fairly calm and collected synthesis that tries to say, well, realistically, you don't have to accept the old accounts in whole cloth. You don't have to accept the demolition accounts. So can you get a fairly sober, sensible account of what happened? And my argument is, yes, I believe you can.
You are listening to Currents and Religion. I'm speaking with Philip Jenkins about his new book, A Storm of Images, which is out now from Baylor University Press. So tell us about that sober and balanced account. What for you are some of maybe the major takeaways that readers will find in your book if they come to it looking for something about this era?
Right. One of the things I think that people will be surprised by is we always assume that, there are documents out there and we can find them. Both sides were absolutely ruthless in destroying the documents of their rivals, even if the other side was the work of one of the greatest Roman emperors of all time, a man called Constantine V. He was anti-image. He wrote a lot, virtually all destroyed. A little bit is preserved in accounts that are meant to demolish his arguments. But when you look at what these people were saying, it's not crazy. It's making very good points. You can also at least make some estimate as to where these arguments are coming from against images. Partly it's what you might call a conservative account. Partly it's a continuation of a debate that had gone on in the Middle East in the Levant for 200 or 300 years before this, where Christians had been in fairly constant argument with Jews, and images had been one of the great sources. So what happened is a lot of the Christian versus Jewish arguments get transformed wholesale into the icon struggle. There are some other things which I found very interesting, which is this is the age of the great Islamic conquests. There have been all these terrible wars and persecutions around the place. Virtually everyone who's involved in this conflict is a refugee from somewhere, which gives it, in a sense, a very modern kind of appeal. These are refugees who are carrying the ideas of their older societies to Constantinople and starting these different wars. And one other argument I think would be of interest to anyone who's interested in Christianity. Everyone who knows about Christianity knows that there are all these great early heresies in the second, third centuries. They all had their lost gospels and so on. And we assume they just went away. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're all still very much around in the 8th and 9th centuries. They've got different names. But if we track the arguments that are used against images, a lot of them come from these really old heresies. I mean, I use one example. If you study very early Christianity in the around the year 200, there's a very influential sect called the Montanists, who are in Asia Minor. In the year 720, 500 years later, the Roman emperor is still trying to pass laws to stamp out Montanists, as in, and this time we mean it. It gives you the idea of how much totally unexpected religious diversity there is within the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. with all these Christian sects and Jewish sects and so on. And the nature of the debate is much more diverse, polyphonic, multi-sided than I think we ever gave it credit for. Mm-hmm. So there are some things, but maybe for me, one of the most important takeaways is just in how many tantalizing ways these conflicts foreshadow the arguments of the Reformation. Many of the Reformation scholars were very interested in the icon struggle and had strong views about it. So, for example, John Calvin was very sympathetic to one of the iconoclastic councils, and he actually denounced what became the Orthodox Council. So he was pro-iconoclast, and his followers, followed him very literally. I actually take the title Storm of Images from a series of campaigns by Calvinists in the 1560s to destroy images in Catholic churches.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And this connection with the way that the controversy over images tantalizingly parallels the Reformation debates in more ways than just on images. You end up linking that to social reformation more generally. Say a little bit more about this.
Yeah. There are so many arguments about what is driving the image struggle, as far as we can tell. A lot of people argue for a strong gender element, that women are strongly pro-image. They support the monks and the religious orders, which is certainly something that is true in the Reformation era of the 16th, 17th centuries. If only we had more evidence to support it, it's probably true, but it's a little bit hard to tell. The Roman Empire is a very diverse kind of community with all these different ethnic groups, linguistic groups. As far as we can tell, the anti-image forces, the iconoclastic forces, come from the other people, the non-Greeks, people like the Armenians, who are very strong, a lot of the people in Asia Minor. So there are these social agendas going on. You know, it's certainly not a neat division. Right. There are lots of places where families are fighting within themselves. Literally, brother is killing brother. But generally speaking, you can draw some lines like that.
Mm-hmm. And you allude to ways that thinking about the controversy over images could be relevant for understanding some of our social reformations today.
Yeah, I began writing this book, I suppose, in 2020. And I would argue that 2020 was a great age of iconoclasm in the modern world, in the United States. That, of course, is the age when you have the George Floyd protests, and those spill over to the destruction of Confederate monuments, Confederate names, and not just that, but anyone connected with slavery. You know, we saw the renaming of Fort Hood in Texas because Hood was a Confederate commander. And at every stage, it was the same sort of action as you had in the iconoclastic era, which has to make us think, what is going on? Why do people feel the need to attack or remove inanimate objects, which of themselves clearly cannot do any direct harm, but the idea is they can do symbolic harm? And so, one thinks through this and you think partly it's the fact of removal, but also it's the statement of being able to remove these things is a very powerful symbolic statement in its own right. It shows what a different group can do against the power of the authorities. It can be a declaration that we are now at year zero. We're going to start a new world. And images, we tend not to use the word reformation these days because that's a very religious idea, but we certainly use concepts of sweeping clean, of of revolution. The other analogy would be what happened at the end of communism when they brought down all the images of Lenin and communism. So I would suggest that when you look at iconoclasm, you're seeing a classic example of a movement that has very often recurred through history at revolutionary moments. And we really can find a lot out about what drives these. Do they come from above? Do they come from below? What's their symbolic importance? And I use the word vandal. Interestingly, in the 1790s, there was one of these great movements by the French Revolution against the old symbols of Catholicism and the aristocratic order. And one writer of the time protested and said, "Oh, you're just a bunch of vandals." And that's the word he invented from the old, from the ancient barbarians. So we've been here often before. Maybe something like an iconoclastic movement is one of the recurring drivers of cultural, political, and religious change.
Fascinating. Dr. Philip Jenkins, thank you so much for taking time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Dr. Jenkins for joining us and to you all for making Currents a part of your day. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with somebody that you think might like it too. And if you'd like to help get the word out more, you could subscribe or leave a review. Thanks. Next week, our guest is Dr. Susan Benton, a friend of mine and a graduate from Baylor's PhD program in religion, who was recently appointed as a lecturer in religion and ministry guidance here at Baylor. We will talk with her about her research on women in the New Testament and the Greco-Roman world, and the way Baylor's religion department prepares undergraduate students for futures in ministry. Until then, take care.